Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It is time to click both heads in 2025 with MindClickers Season 6, Episode 3. Today, I'm joined by Christian Statter, gaming and esports researcher and university lecturer with over a decade of hands-on experience across 70-plus events since 2011. Christian runs an online blog and newsletter breaking down high-performance topics in esports, and in today's episode, we'll dive into some of these key themes, including how sound impacts gameplay, the influence on personality traits like risk-taking and narcissism, and how fatigue affects player performance. We'll also unpack some insights from his previous major research reviews. Whether you're a player, coach, or esports enthusiast, this is one you really don't want to miss. Let's get into it. Christian, welcome on board.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to nerd out with you.
No, I'm very keen. I'm sure that I've got a lot of pro players, a lot of coaches, managers, they'll be tuning in and keen to unpack some of your insights and I guess some of your experience in the past. So break it down for us. We usually love to have this little first segment on MindClickers, I guess, understanding your backstory, how you got into esports and the gaming world. So break it down for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So my story in gaming really starts at an early age. You know, like most people, I started just playing, and the game I played the most back in the days was like World of Warcraft. I think that was kind of a stepping stone for a lot of people. And then back in 2010, I found a website called Own TV, which is like a very old school Twitch stuff, kind of like another company. And there were a lot of World of Warcraft players streaming their gameplay. So I watched the website, and someday I found this guy streaming this new game called StarCraft II. And this is when I really got into StarCraft RTS games. And at some point, I just reached out to the guy asking if they need any help because they had like a small company in Germany. And he was like, yeah, sure, we need a newsletter writer, someone who keeps updating the websites and stuff like that. And so I was like, yeah, why not? Let's just do it. And then I went to all the Gamescom, doing interviews with some of the StarCraft 2 players. And at some point, I think it was 2012, when I reached out to Dennis Gehm, the founder of Take TV. Some of you might know him for like Home Story Cups. And then I started doing the tournaments with them as a freelancer, like all the Home Story Cups, some Hearthstone tournaments back in the day, Seed Story Cups. And at one tournament, I met one of the guys from DreamHack who was working there as well. And he asked me if I wanted to join for one of the DreamHack StarCraft 2 events. And at the same time, I was like studying because I study business administration. And that semester, when a tournament in Sweden happened, I didn't have anything to do. My exams were all done, all great. And I was like, yeah, you know, why not? Let's just reach out to him and ask if I can join the tournament. He was like, yeah, absolutely. So I flew to Sweden, worked the tournament, and then he asked me if I wanted to do more tournaments, and that's how I got into DreamHack. So I started working with them, doing all the WCS events, working with Blizzard. And at some point, I was also doing some of the IEM Katowice tournaments. Then I reached out to more people, and then I shifted a little bit into Counter-Strike. So I did some Counter-Strike tournaments for Blast, and yeah, it's basically a broad view right now. But currently, I'm studying more on my, like, finishing my PhD. So I took a little bit of a backstep from actual tournaments. But yeah, as you already mentioned, I did like over 70 tournaments over the past couple of years, and it's kind of like my story.
Love it. Seen a lot, especially within the EU region. You know, you're very lucky to sort of have so many lands and I guess like experiences over there, because down here in Australia, we don't have too many. In OCE, APAC, we're not really blessed with that many down here. But yeah.
But you guys are getting some of the tournaments, right? Like Counter-Strike tournaments.
Counter-Strike are happening in Sydney. IEM Sydney is pretty good. I got a good reception last time I was here, whether it was this year or last year. Yeah, hopefully there's some more in the future. But I think it is predominantly CS based at the moment. I don't really see us. There's been talks of a Rocket League major in Australia, but it's just so hard to fly so many teams to Australia. It's expensive. So there's all those sort of extra costs that take into consideration. But yeah, we'll see what happens. What is your PhD studying?
My PhD focuses on individual and team performance in esports.
Mm. Okay, I love that. What was the, I guess, driving factor to study that? I guess from going from business admin to now doing a different, I guess, esports performance structure, what was the sort of that driving motivator?
My motivator was that I, as I already mentioned, at the point when I started my PhD, I was like really into esports, like traveling a lot, doing all these tournaments. And with my background in gaming, I was just like, yeah, this is something I want to do. This is something I want to explore. And at the same time, you could say the, if you have it from a, like a list top down, the second thing on my list was that I wanted to give something back to the gaming and esports community. Because I really grew up in this kind of scene, and I realized there people are just playing, and at some point it's not really healthy. It's not really good what they're doing. And this is also what the research shows, that the practices and performance related factors aren't really there. It's not at the same level as we have it in most other sports. So I thought, you know, like giving back to the community by doing some research, exploring stuff, helping people. And this is also one of the driving factors why I started my blog, you know, it's like trying to educate people a little bit more about gaming, the scientific background, and just try to give them some helpful advice.
I love that. It's probably the very, I guess, same reason I started MindClickers, right? To sort of have on pro players, have on coaches, have on people like yourself to provide insights into those that it's a bit of a question mark. Like traditional sports is so well researched, it's so well explored. There's so many podcasts, but we look to esports and, you know, what does an esports player think on stage? How do they feel? What does their warm-up look like, right? I think that's the more question marks or the more individualization that's not really explored within esports. So I think it's really cool to unravel, share, and explore. So yeah, I love that. It's almost, yeah, very similar to me, giving back for my, I guess, pro experience and, yeah, having a bit of insight and providing those, which is awesome.
I mean, you probably have a lot of insights from like a very practical perspective. So you can probably also relate to some of the stuff we might talk about and have like a different perspective on it and like in general.
Absolutely. That'll be interesting. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the big thing about esports is that there's a lot of individualization towards it, especially if you have teams of, you know, for example, in Rocket League, there's only three players, right? One player is 33% of the team in comparative to like League of Legends or CS, where there's one player is 20%. So there's a lot more, I guess, varying individual factors which play into a team-based setting and a team culture. And I think that's a pretty good segue for our first sort of, I guess, topic in terms of how important is it, I guess, in your mind, establishing, you know, a team environment, a team culture for an esports team. You know, previously on all of my teams, it's about, I guess, having expectations for performance, but then also trying to manage them as well, because a lot of players sometimes think about, okay, I have to make top two, I have to make finals, I have to have all these sort of pressures that they put on themselves. So I think it's a fine balance between managing expectations from a player perspective, but also from an organization perspective as well, right? Because they're the ones paying the salary, they're the ones providing the support. So I think it's a bit of a tricky balance sometimes.
Yes. So speaking from a scientific perspective of what we know and what we don't know is that there isn't much research on like an organizational level and how it impacts performance, how it impacts the players. Most of the research is more about the individual and some of the evolving factors or practices, you could say, you have and their impact on performance. But there are a few studies, and as you already pointed out, is that stress is a very big thing. And we have a lot of research, especially from the guys from Australia, because I think you guys are may not be blessed with a lot of tournaments, but you actually have a lot of esports researcher in your region. And one of them is like Dylan Paulus, and he did a lot of research on stress, coping mechanisms. And what they found together with a few other guys like Oliver Leis from Germany is that players typically are stressed by their other teammates. So either their performance or how they behave. But if you look at professional players, the factor that stresses them the most is like social media. That's factor number one. And the second thing is their own performance. So what they think about is like, oh, what have they have on their mind and what stresses them is like looking at social media, probably getting flamed if you performed really bad. There is going to be a Reddit thread.
Yeah.
People are going to spam you on X or whatnot. And the second thing is, like, if you're in a tournament and your performance is terrible or you don't know how you're going to perform, you may be sick or whatever, then this is going to stress you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you know, I might not be able to perform today at my top level, my teammate is probably not going to perform really good. And this is just like what puts a lot of stress on them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that you broke that down really nicely. There's so many, I guess, external factors which can have an influence on a player's performance. And definitely looking towards socials, you know, I've had a lot of previous experience with some of my players whereby, you know, here in OCE, we're at the top of the region, but obviously because we're so far away from some places, having a boot camp is one of the most important necessities for us. So even if we have a boot camp, you know, we would go over for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we practice, we scrim, then it comes to LAN and we don't perform quite as well just because the level of competition is so high on an international standard. And then straight away, the first thing is, and it happened most recently, we didn't do too well at a LAN, and they're like, because currently OCE has two spots at a Rocket League Major. And then you see on Reddit, you see on X, you see everywhere, remove one of the spots. OCE only deserves one spot. And, you know, that plays a big, I guess, driving factor from a player as well, having, I guess, that pressure to know that, hey, you know, it's not just me, it's potentially the whole region in my hands as well.
Like, what is your experience when it comes to having players look at social media as well? Because I heard, like, when I did all the tournaments and stuff, I heard that there are teams out there who, they don't forbid it, but they really advise their players to not look at social media at all, just to completely avoid this kind of like negative impact on them.
Yeah, predominantly most of my players previously haven't been too active on socials. Like a few of them were streamers, but not really. Some of them had to do like obviously mandatory sort of social posts for the org, but in that instance, it's more of a post and ghost sort of thing.
Yeah.
Sort of post it and just let it ride, let it drift into the sunset sort of thing. But yeah, in terms of like, I guess, more individualized posts on Twitter, you don't really see it too much. It's more so, you know, just a repost or something like that. So, which I think is good. I think it's definitely tricky to find the balance though, for sure.
It is. But I guess most of your players are like really focused on performing their best, like professional players. And they're not streaming anymore, I guess. So for them, social media is more like something that happens at the same time, but it's not really important, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things that's sort of in the background, which I think is an interesting sort of segue, because we look towards some pro players who do take the content creation path, right? And sort of they're a pro player, and then they go and become a mainstream Twitch streamer. And so I think there's an interesting conversation there about that micromanagement of, you know, balancing that, because what does life look like after a professional playing career? Is it possible to go into, you know, YouTube content creation? Is it possible to have a more of a stronger social media presence because you worked on building it up through your pro career? I think that is definitely an interesting aspect that I've had conversations in the past about, but a lot of the players that I've talked about weren't too interested. They might have been studying while being a pro or had a different side sort of they're working on, but I definitely think it's an interesting thing, especially for those players that want to go into being, you know, a full-time YouTuber or full-time Twitch streamer.
Yeah. There's actually a study out there that looked at how pro players behaved when it comes to their career from before Corona and till after COVID. And what they found was that a lot of players, professional players, switched from being professional players, from playing professionally, to becoming streamers. So I think it was kind of like this thing that you couldn't do tournaments anymore, like live tournaments, offline tournaments. And at the same time, Twitch got a really big boost from so many players getting into gaming, watching. So I think there was like this very nice sweet spot for them for like, yeah, I might not be the best player, but I'm somewhat entertaining. There are a lot of people watching. You can make a lot of money. And that's when a lot of people switched. Also, you didn't have, I don't know how it was in Australia, but you couldn't have like team houses. You couldn't see your teammates. Everything was online.
Yeah.
And yeah, some of the players just quit at that point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't even think in Australia there's a single team house that exists. I think everyone just plays online from home. I think that's an interesting sort of segue we might even transition to potentially, because I think it's pretty interesting. The idea of playing in your own sort of environment, and I guess that cultured environment that you have in comparative to, I guess, going to a LAN setting and being exposed to stage, right? I think that's one thing a lot of players sometimes don't prepare for or don't even acknowledge is a preparation factor, right? I remember the first time I went to LAN in Sweden with one of my boys, and he'd never sort of been on a LAN stage before. And, you know, you take into account crowds, you take into account cameras, you take into account lights, take into account sounds, all those external factors which you don't get in your bedroom, right? You might have a ring light for your camera if you're, you know, whatever you're doing, but it's all those sort of minute things that all of a sudden there's all this sort of noise around you, and it's tricky to deal with.
What do you think is like the most stressing factor when going from your home environment to a offline tournament?
I would say the lights. I'd say that
light.
There's been multiple LANs where I can think of where players just haven't been used to like giant bright lights just in front of us, especially lights that come down. There's been lights that are from behind that come onto the PC screen and create like a bit of a glare. And we've had to be like, we can't actually even see the game. Like, you know, can we get that changed? And it's like, oh, this is production, yada, yada. So I think that's definitely an interesting factor that I've had a lot of conversations with in the past with players. Probably second to that would be dealing with stage, dealing with crowds, dealing with audience members. Very much so how, you know, traditional sports players deal with crowds out on the soccer field or on the football field. So I think that's, yeah, probably the predominantly main two factors.
Yeah. Like the crowd was also one of the major driving factors when it comes to stress in the study I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
And from an experience perspective, you know, I mostly worked as a tournament admin, like head admin. And the request to turn down the lights or like change the direction of the lights pretty much happened like every tournament.
I'd imagine.
Because, you know, production is setting it up so it looks really nice on camera, on stream and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you got the pro players and they just have like, as you already said, lights directly shining into their face or you can't see the screen properly and stuff. So we usually have to turn down the lights at least during the game that we otherwise wouldn't.
Yeah, that's crazy. Have you had any working as an admin, any, I guess, PC malfunctions, anything like that that's sort of happened in the past you've had to deal with, that sort of tricky errors?
Pretty much every tournament. Like you can,
I was going to say.
No, like you can test as much as you want, but the moment players come in and they set up everything, something is just not going to work anymore. It's like, I don't know why it is, but it is what it is. But I remember two very specific tournaments. The first one was a Quake 2 tournament we had in Sweden.
Cool.
And we tested everything. Everything was great. Sound was awesome. And then the players set up and we started playing the tournament. And at some point, some of the players said, well, I can't hear my teammates, right? So we checked everything and we didn't know why it was not working anymore. There was some static 24/7 and we couldn't get it sorted out. So for day two, we swapped computers, we tested, we couldn't figure out what was wrong. And to circumvent the problem, we even set up a separate computer behind stage just for the communication between the players. And it still didn't work.
Right.
And we had no idea why. And to this date, we don't know, but we think it was something related to the stage. Maybe the stage wasn't probably grounded.
Mm.
So we got the static and there was just like no fix for it. Like not at all.
Yeah, a little bit of a crazy.
Players absolutely hated it. And interestingly, like if you move to the side, like maybe half a meter, then it was completely gone. Communication was crystal clear. But if you move back into the spot where the players were sitting, like it was back.
Oh, wow. Headache central, because it's pretty common is it common for CS players to use in-ears? Because in Rocket League, no, not a single pro uses in-ears, just mainly predominantly headphones.
I think it really depends when it comes down to the tournament. Right. Usually they have in-ears and then you have like soundproofed headphones on top. What we did in StarCraft, and I think this is also the same for like Counter-Strike tournaments, is that you have noise-canceling headphones and you put in an put on the noise canceling and you also play some white noise or pink noise at the same time. So that you really want to make sure that players can hear their teammates, can hear the game sound, but can't hear anything else from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of just had a bit of a weird reflection back. I remember sort of old, not really old school, but like a while back, I remember just seeing LANs and players being in booths, but I feel like that's not as common nowadays. I feel like there's more exposure. Yeah, it's more outside, not in a booth.
Yeah, this is something that emerged back in the days, like maybe 2012 to 2014, when we had all these StarCraft II tournaments and they would set up a booth for the players, ACs in there. So everything was nice and the players absolutely loved it. Like it was really good. But the reason they stopped doing it was that you couldn't ship them pretty well.
Oh,
so if you have a tournament, if you have a tournament in Sweden and the week after you have a tournament in the US, then you had to ship the entire box over there. And that was physically impossible. And at the same time, you didn't want to have a second, third, whatever location in the US, in Canada, whatever, just to have the booth ready there, because it's pretty expensive to store them. To have like all the separate booths as well, and yeah, just shipping is not going to happen. So at some point they switched to something else, which is just like soundproof playing white noise.
Yeah
just more convenient.
Yeah, no, absolutely makes perfect sense. I guess whilst we're on the topic of sound, I'd love to sort of segue into one of the articles you write about sound versus no sound, I guess the importance of playing with sound. For me personally, I used to play Rocket League with no sound. And as soon as I said that on LAN, I almost got like 50 death stares. Like, what are you talking about? You need to hear boost. You need to hear if someone's going to demo you, whatever it was. But I don't know. I just felt like more majestic without sound. I felt like I could flow a little bit better. So I guess breaking down, what is this phenomenon about, I guess, sound versus no sound? Is there, you know, what does the research sort of tell us and what does it look at?
Well, from a scientific perspective, there's just like one, maybe two studies I found on the topic. And the ones that I found is it's pretty 50-50. Like if you play music, some players can deal really well with it and their performance goes up. And for some players, it's just like in-game, no music, and that's what increases their performance. So I think it's very much a personal thing.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, the game or like game sounds are a source of information. So as a player, you want to make sure you have as much information as possible, especially if you play games where you have like incomplete information, like League of Legends, StarCraft 2, or whatever. And if you're playing and you only see part of the map on your screen, then game sounds may provide for you an information you otherwise wouldn't have.
Yep.
Like if something happens on the other side of the map, then you're going to be aware of it due to sound. But if you mute the sound, then you're not going to have the information. At the same time, there are people, maybe this is also the case for you where you didn't play with sound, is that they can just perform better, they can focus better, get in flow better without any sounds, like when it's just completely silent around them. And this is also the case for myself. When I'm working, I have nothing on, like no sound whatsoever. And I just know or feel that I can just focus better and be more productive.
Yeah, interesting. Do you think that a level of intuition comes into play when talking about that? Just the feeling of perhaps, I guess, playing devil's advocate, like playing League and looking at timings, and you might think or suggest that someone's going to jungle, so you might look over there at a different time, not purely just listening for the sound, but just knowing or having a feeling that something might happen?
Yeah. I think if you play without sound, you're just going to adapt at some point, and adapting might just be looking at the map more often.
Yeah.
And then just becoming aware, or maybe looking at the chat, what people are talking, or pings, whatever, And a ping can also be with or without sound, so you don't necessarily need it to see the ping, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that, say, for example, we're playing 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, do you think there's an ability for us to become desensitized to audio cues?
I wouldn't say desensitized. I think if you're playing for that long of a time, it's more like that sound or like a noisy environment is going to exhaust you.
Mm-hmm.
So your resilience to this kind of environment, especially if you play offline, if you're very stressed, just goes down over time. So goes your performance, right? So I don't think it's desensitizing. It's more like being stressed, not having the resilience anymore, the mental focus, resources, if you want to call it that, to withstand the sound.
Yeah. I think there's so many multifacets that play into performance, especially at the top level, that it's hard to really nail it down to one thing, especially when there is so many things to focus on, right?
How are you dealing with the music? Like, I know from sports and also from my experience in esports that some of the players just enjoy listening to some very uplifting music at the start of the game or before the game. And then when the game starts, they turn it off and listen to like game sound or no sound.
Yeah, I've got a very funny story. So first ever major in Sweden, we were doing PC setups and we had like the admins to do SSD setup to make sure that everything's good so that come game day, they can just put the SSD in and we're all good to go. I remember vividly one of my players didn't open Rocket League, didn't open anything. The first thing he opened was Spotify just to make sure that's all good, make sure that sounds good.
Yeah.
And then come with that game day, I just remember, I think we're in the pregame lobby, just like testing ping, make sure everything was good. And he was just making sure he had the right hardstyle song, like the right techno song. And I'm like, Calm, you sure you want to listen to that? Are you going to be able to hear them calm? He's like, doesn't worry, bro. I'm in the zone, you know? And just, yeah, that uplifting energy was what made him lock in and focus. And whether that was something he predominantly did, you know, growing up throughout the pro career, I'm not too sure. I can't quite remember, but yeah, definitely one of those things that for specific players can have a bit of that trigger effect that, all right, now we're on land, now it's time to go sort of thing, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah. So from an anecdotal perspective, this is the same experience I had. There is one StarCraft II player who for a long time listened to the exact same song every single time before the game starts or like at the start of the match, which was Forgot About Dre by Eminem.
Oh, yeah.
So this was like a song he was just like rapping and he was on camera like doing like this and going with the flow.
Yeah.
And that just really helped him to like get into the zone, get into the flow.
Unwind a bit.
And in the early days, there was also a Swedish player who enjoyed watching Funny Cat videos before playing a tournament game.
Right.
So every time the match was about to start, he had 5 minutes left, whatever, and he just fired up one of their funny videos. And it just put him in a very good mood, positive mood, and then he was like ready to perform.
Love that. I think that's great. I think, yeah, having that, I guess, pre-game ritual that's, I guess, unique to that individual. Yep. I think it's pretty cool, especially when I've had players talk about it before and then I've people try to copy it. But, you know, the thing is that becomes not individualized, right? So I think that's probably a good sort of, I guess, you know, headliner in terms of, I guess, finding your own individualized pregame warm-up, what works for you might not work for someone else, right? So it's important to sort of understand what you do and sort of, yeah, drive home with that, which I think... a bit of a slight segue, but I think it's really interesting to talk about the topic of potentially placebos, right? Some players going to land wearing their lucky socks, wearing their favorite t-shirt, and having that pre-game ritual instilled in something that's physical. Is there any research out there that sort of goes into anything about placebos?
Haven't seen any when it comes to gaming, but I would argue that these kind of rituals are really just a way of coping with stress.
Yeah.
Because you're in this environment, you're trying to lock in, you're trying to have everything the same way you have it at home. You just do what you always do and hope for the best. But I think it doesn't work for most of the players. Maybe you have some experience on that, but if you have a ritual that you do at home and you play an online tournament, it's going to be very different from doing the same ritual or trying to do the same ritual offline, and it might not work.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe you actually need different rituals for online or offline tournaments.
Yeah, 100%. I've got a bit of a good anecdotal story from that. There was one online regional championship, it was Championship Sunday, and it was one last, it just made the finals. And every single time we made a finals, my players would like to go outside, and for him to sort of de-stress and to sort of reset his mental, he'd just get a bit of cold air and look at the moon. Like, he's looking at the moon was his favorite thing to do. And then translate that to LAN, he wanted to go outside, but all of a sudden there's no moon. All of a sudden there's a sun. So there was a bit of a different environment that he was put in. So he couldn't really have, I guess, specific individualized pregame warm-up that he enjoyed, because all of a sudden it wasn't cold, fresh air. It was really hot. You know, it was a bit different. That didn't really, I guess, put him into the same mindset. So I think that's an important consideration, prioritizing, I guess, individual warm-ups around things that you're able to control, which I think is pretty important.
Yeah. From what I've heard from some of the teams is they try to set up the same ritual that works online and offline, which is focus on something that the team can do together.
Yep.
I think this is one of the things where you see in sports, people come together in a circle and they have like a chant or whatever. And this is something you can do online and offline.
Yep.
So it works all the time. And I think this is what they focus on and try to reset it to become like their ritual.
Yeah, absolutely. Can definitely amend to that. I'm a big fan of doing huddles. Did them online. And even though you can't really physically create a huddle online, you can definitely say, hey, boys, just something I want to say real quick. And then in comparative to being in person and being in a huddle and looking at each other, that has a little bit more of an intrinsic effect. Definitely something I love doing. And there was a really funny blooper that we did at Esports World Cup last year where we did the huddle. And then they put the video camera below us, so it was like looking up at us.
Yep.
And I completely stuffed up the wording of what I was saying. But yeah, definitely having a huddle or something that you can control is, definitely awesome and important.
Yeah. This huddling and the camera below is something that started like, I think, a year ago, and you see it at a lot of major tournaments these days.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice way for the viewers as well to get like in a more closer look of what's happening. You can be closer to the teams as well.
Yeah. It definitely creates like an emotive response towards, okay, like this team's actually, you know, meaning business. They're getting pretty serious with it.
Yeah. Now I'm kind of curious, like, what do you tell your players? Like, do you have the same speech or like similar speech? What do you use? How do you structure it?
I usually structure it about having no regrets, because I always say the same thing. Say it's a Saturday or say it's a Friday, usually the same thing. Come Sunday, every single one of these players that are around us is going to pack up their suitcase and walk out the hotel, and they're going to look back and the hotel is going to be in the distance, right? And by that stage, they can't change anything. So the last thing that I want you to do is when you're on that bus away from that hotel, driving towards the airport, be like, oh, I wish in that moment I would have done this. I wish I would have done that. I would have said something different. I wish I would have spoke up. I wish I would have had a little bit more confidence in myself to believe that I can actually do, you know, something specific. So the last thing I want is for you to be on that bus and have regrets. Okay. So go out here with no regrets and actually believe and trust the process. And I go into a lot of trusting and in terms of really formulating that, I guess, culture that we've sort of been focusing on. And yeah, predominantly have it around having no regrets and actually giving it 110%, which I usually does really well.
That's actually a pretty good one. I think it kind of releases the players from being too constrained or not like thinking, oh, maybe I should speak up, maybe I shouldn't, I should say this, maybe I shouldn't. Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, because sometimes a lot of players that I've had experiences in the past have gotten in their heads about, you know, should I say something between games? Should I not? Should I just remain silent?
Yeah.
Especially the big one in Rocket Leagues during a timeout, right? I think there was stats that came out that after a timeout, the game win ratio was like 75%. So the chance of winning a game after a timeout was like pretty high, like 75-80%. So the importance of, I guess, taking that timeout properly and, you know, saying something you want to say, or, you know, whatever approach you want to have in that timeout is pretty important. So yeah, making sure that during that timeout, saying whatever you want to say and making sure that, you know, you go into it with full confidence.
That's great. How often do you take timeouts, or like when do you take them? Like when a team is losing, or also when a team is winning?
So in a best of seven, you get one timeout.
Okay.
Yeah. So usually you use that if you go down two games. So like if you're 0-2 down, some teams like to take it when they go 0-3 down, but then they have to reverse sweep, and that's a tall order, right? So yeah, predominantly it's when you go 0-2 down. I've had one example. It was an online regional where I think we won a game, and my player said, let's take the timeout, because he wanted to go get a banana and just like chill for like a minute and a half. And the online commentators were like, what is happening with Renegades? What are they doing? You know, why are they taking a timeout? And then a cue to CJ's camera, who's just sitting there having a banana, just like chilling, which was good. And a lot of people in the chat were like, BM, BM, that's BM sort of thing. But, you know, we still won the regional, so does it really matter?
Yeah. Like if you feel like that this helps you to get into the zone or like increase your chances of winning, to be more comfortable, I think just absolutely go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Love it. Now, another sort of interesting topic that I saw on your site was this whole idea of, narcissism and risk-taking and participating, behavior that you can be a little bit more, egotistic in terms of what you want to do. So, you know, what's that all about? Sort of break that down.
So usually when we're talking about these kind of traits, then we have to a little bit differentiate between what traits actually are. If you're talking about personality traits, then what comes to mind is like the Big Five model,
yep,
just like the standard in psychology, sometimes also called the Ocean model, which is Ocean. Each letter stands for like openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and narcissism.
Yep.
Narcissism, neuroticism. And the other thing when we're talking about traits is like everything else, like something that players also brings to the table, like as you said, risk-taking behavior, narcissism, or any other traits they may have. And if you look at the research in gaming, then the results are a little bit mixed when it comes to personality traits.
Mm.
So, for instance, some of the research found that extroversion, agreeableness, and low conscientiousness contribute to performance. And some others found that you need high openness and experiences, low neuroticism, and high conscientiousness. So just to detangle this a little bit, and maybe this is something that you have personal experience with, because if you have a team, then you want to try to set up the team so each player like compensates for the, let's say, the lack of skills or whatever of the other players.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to have like the best players on the team if you can't have a team, but just a group of players, they're not going to perform as well. And personality traits are one of the many factors of that. So if we're talking about openness is something that orients people towards abstraction or like ideas. People who are high in openness, they really like ideas. They're more or less introverts, especially when we talk about gamers, because gamers are usually not very open. They're more like introverted.
Yep.
They're also into fantasy, but they're also novelty seeking. So some players maybe enjoy finding new strategies, and that's what gives them a crucial edge over other people. When we talk about conscientiousness is, after IQ, the second biggest predictor for long-term success. And people who are conscientious are very diligent, they're very orderly, they really like a schedule, they really like the rituals that we talked before.
Yeah.
They're very industriousness, so they can just sit down for hours and hours and be concentrated and grind and learn. When we talk about extroversion, it's something like emotional stability. This is something that may come into play when you're playing tournaments, because you want to be mentally stable, you want to be resilient.
Yeah.
But people who are extroverted are also the people who like to go out, party, meet different people and stuff. Then we have agreeableness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think agreeableness is something that is very interesting, especially in team games, Because people that are high in agreeableness, they are more passionate, they are more polite, they more care for other people, they don't like conflict, and they're typically also non-competitive.
Mm.
However, people who care for other people might be exactly the same people who play support roles in 5v5 tournaments.
Yeah.
Or if you were talking about Rocket League, I don't know much about the game, but maybe just something that resonates with you, that you have a player who doesn't really care about scoring goals, but it's more about making sure that the rest of the team is set up to be in a good position, kind of like the support player, if you want, in that sense as well. And the last one is neuroticism. Neuroticism is negative emotions. So it's the ability to withstand stress, but you don't want to be high. You want to be low in neuroticism. So you want to be resilient against negative emotions.
Mm.
And this is also be associated with being more self-aware. So you can focus on yourself. You can analyze yourself better. It's also associated with self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And all these different traits, I think, make a person unique. And this uniqueness plays into the role of how you want to create your team and which player you want to have on your team. Because as I said, if you have the three best players, but they don't have the right character, they're not going to perform. But yeah, this is maybe something that you have like a personal experience with.
Mm. It's interesting. Like, hearing that, all that makes complete sense. And I've just been thinking, like, when we do, I guess, we search for a new player, you know, is there now or should there be a consideration towards a personality test in terms of, you know, their back end, how they think, how they feel, how they look towards a team setting? Because that's definitely something I've not even ever considered. I don't even know if other teams potentially out there doing that. But predominantly, I think the always go-to is like results-based, right? Like, how has this been player? Has this player been doing? Is it LAN? Is it online? Is it, you know, what are their results? And I think we base a lot based on results. And that creates almost a bit like of an overcast over the players who have the potential who might be the right fit. So, yeah, personality test or looking deeper beyond results, I think, could be a really interesting new meta.
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting aspect because if you look at it from a broader perspective, then the personality of a player really just influences their value structure at the level of perception.
Yep.
So it's more about their goals and what they value. And depending on that, they will be more extroverted, more conscientious and whatnot. So by looking at this, you may have a better player. But at the same time, if you have someone who values certain things more than the other, for instance, the support player, and that player might be a better fit for your team.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. It's definitely something that's, definitely made me question and think about it for sure. Something that I have never really considered because, you know, previously I'm sort of reflecting back on teams now. It's definitely clear in the past 3-4 teams that I've been on that there's always one player who definitely plays or definitely is a little bit more reserved in the team. They're not always the first player to speak up. They're always the one person to sort of listen to everyone first. And then in comparison, there's always one person who, it's hard on a Rocket League team, you've got three players, right, in comparison to a different team. But there's always a leader that always stands out, someone who is happy to speak first, someone that after a loss is the first person to say, you know, hey, boys, look, you know, unfortunately, we didn't get across the line, but da-da-da, right? So I think that's important in the aspect of, each team has to sort of have a leader. And I guess what if there's no one on the team who has the personality of becoming a leader? Is it then about building the confidence to try and take the leap into that leader position? Is it about trying to learn those skills? I think that's a very interesting sort of area.
Yeah. Like leadership is something that is relatively well explored in gaming and research because there are a few studies out there. And what these studies find is that you want to have a distributed leadership meaning that you don't want have one person making all the calls and all the decisions. It's more like switching, especially when it's role-based. So let's say in Counter-Strike, when the leader dies, then you want to have someone else take over this role. And this may be the same in Rocket League. If one of the guys is not feeling well, you know, he isn't performing well, then maybe it's a good idea to have a second person over there who just takes over for the day or for the match or whatever and speaks up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've definitely had that happen before, that there's been a land where our usual sort of guy who's the one to speak up wasn't feeling too well. So it definitely fell on someone else and obviously myself to sort of help be in that combination. But I think that makes perfect sense, especially in a Counter-Strike sense, whereby if the IGL dies and all of a sudden someone else takes over, and it's a bit more of a cohesive team effort rather than putting all the pressure on the IGL to make every single correct decision. And that just places potentially a bit more stress on him.
Yeah. So now switching to the other side of traits we talked about. If we look at risk-taking behavior that you mentioned before, I found two studies on that, and one of them basically said men are more risk-taking compared to women, which we know there's a biological basis for that, mostly due to testosterone. And this may also be a reason why men are much more competitive and much more driven to esports in general. Yep. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of women who are very competitive and stuff, but talking about the general population, men are much more risk-taking or show a much more risk-taking behavior, which I think has a biological component to it. And a second component is also the culture.
Yeah.
So there was one study who looked at the culture of American and Chinese players, and they took the data from the international Dota 2 tournament and compared them. And what they found was that American players are much more risk-taking compared to Chinese players. So the Chinese players, they didn't pick fights. They were more waiting for it to happen.
Right.
They also made sure that they don't get caught off guard. So they used more wards and they also used more runes in the game.
Interesting.
And Americans are more like, no, let's go in. Let's take the risk. We don't need that many wards. We focus on other items and whatnot. Both can work out. It really depends on, I guess, your team and also the enemy team you're facing.
Interesting. Do you think that aspect of culture, especially plays into, well, I imagine it would, right? I'm just thinking, straight off the bat, League of Legends, top four teams are all Korean, sort of, Chinese based, your Gen.G, T1, all those sort of big teams, predominantly Korean. So potentially there's something there in terms of not taking too many calculated risks, but more, sort of calculated decisions.
Yeah, I think the same, especially when it comes to the perspective of warding, because team games, Dota, League of Legends, you play with incomplete information.
Yeah.
And if you want to take a risk, you might just use fewer wards. But if you use fewer wards, you might get caught off guard. But at the same time, you save the money for better items and whatnot. But generally speaking, if you look at these games at the very top level, I think a major component is just vision. It's just knowing where is someone else, what are they doing, what are they focusing on. Are they setting up a Baron? Are they setting up something else?
Yeah.
And playing off of that can just give you a crucial edge and win you the games. But I think this impact of risk-taking or not risk-taking behavior doesn't play too much of a role in terms of Korean versus non-Korean players. Because I think that the esports industry is much more advanced in China, in South Korea, and I think they just have a very much better structure, team support structure, practice routines and stuff like that. So I think that is a way bigger driving factor for their success.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's really interesting, sort of just hitchhiking on the back of that, that sort of within Asia, there is that dominance within Dota 2 or MOBAs in general, Dota 2, League of Legends, StarCraft even. But yep. I think there is an upcoming surgence within CS. Obviously, we've seen Mongols recently. There's been more of a dominance towards that. Within Rocket League, there isn't too much presence. You know, there's not too many, I guess, Korea. There's not a single Korean pro player, right? Yep. So I think it's interesting that there's so many high players, but the game expansion isn't too wide. Now, I'm curious, like, over the next 5-10 years, is that going to grow, or is it just going to become more selective in terms of what they play?
Yeah, I think it also comes down to the games, because if you look at the distribution of pro gamer across the globe, then you can see, for instance, Counter-Strike is a game that is much, much more popular in Europe and in the US, but in China it's like not really there, right?
Yeah.
And if it's there, then it's not at the same level, like not even close.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure in China they have a different version of CS that I've seen.
Oh, that I don't know about.
Yeah, I've seen OniPix talk about it.
Maybe I could imagine that.
Yeah, because I think that you can't have, because I think in the European or our version of CS, I remember seeing on some of the skins that there's like skulls and stuff, but in the Chinese version, skulls aren't there. So
yeah,
I think there's some different variances. But yeah, no, interesting nonetheless. And I think when you were sort of mentioning that, I reflected back to, I've previously had Pig on, Jared Krenzel, on My Clickers, and we talked about, I guess, StarCraft, and StarCraft being that 1v1, that 1v1 game mode whereby if you take risks, you know, you can capitalize on opportunities, and all of a sudden you can snowball into gaining momentum. So in that game, it's almost like taking risks, the reward is almost instantaneous, but then if you take the risk and it doesn't play out, then it can definitely fall back in your face really fast. So I think that's an interesting game, and obviously game as well, you mentioned in terms of vision, you know, using observer scouting, overlord scouting is important in that game as well, because vision is such an important aspect in StarCraft. So yeah, I think it's very interesting to have those comparisons between games.
Yeah, this is also something that the research literature is really lacking.
Mm.
Like, if you look at the research, then you have a study that either just focuses on one game, or they take the data from players from different games.
Yeah,
but they never compare. Not, I shouldn't say never, but there are very, very few studies who actually compare their results with the results from players of different genres. Mm. So this is something we definitely need, is to see if something they found about team cohesion, about communication, whatever, is the same in Dota as it is in Counter-Strike, as it is in Rocket League or whatever.
Yeah, fantastic. Do you think over the next 5-10 years that there's going to be progressively more dedicated esports research that will arise? Now, obviously,
yeah, I think so.
Traditional esports is abundant in terms of what we're looking at, so many sports to choose from. Obviously, as esports now, I think, is in, you know, almost, would it be its prime? Potentially, obviously, EWC, a lot of audiences, it's for the first time going to be broadcast on TV here in Australia, which I thought was really interesting, because I heard someone the other day being like, oh, you're going to watch it on TV? And it's like, you know, that's something I would not have heard 5-10 years ago, right? So I think the development is fast, but it's also very, very interesting.
Yeah. So looking at it from an economic perspective, you see the inclusion of esports in a lot of areas. As you just mentioned, it's going to be broadcasted on TV. At the same time, there are talks, or it's going to be part of the Olympics.
Yep.
Which makes more sense for the Olympics than it does for esports,
mm-hmm.
just because the population or the people who watch Olympics are on a decline. They're getting older.
Yep.
And they really have a problem to include a newer generation, because the newer generation is just online. They're playing video games. So they're going to include esports just to get people watched and to get the new generation.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. And the other thing, I'm trying to remember what you said first.
No, you're good. I can't even remember what I said first.
No, there was something else I wanted to talk about, which was really interesting. Oh, yeah, exactly. The second part is about research.
Yep.
So the research perspective. I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we will have a lot more research just because we have people who grew up in gaming will also pursue like as a career as a researcher or whatnot. And also we will have more people being aware of esports as a very great source of data. For instance, if you take a regular sports, it's very hard to analyze, for instance, their movement, what they're doing, what they're thinking. But at the same time, in esports, you have these data available because all the major tournaments are broadcasted online. You can actually just pause and look at their behavior.
Yep.
And at the same time, you can overlay this behavioral data with the actual in-game behavior. So what they're doing, you can take CSGO data from demo files that are freely available everywhere on the internet.
Yep.
And that's actually what we are doing with another study right now. You can dive in as deep as you want. You can even analyze their behavior on a level that is 128 pings per second.
Mm.
You can actually exactly see where is the person looking at, what exact angle, when is he firing, why is he firing at that person, why is he standing at exact that position, what happened at the same time during their communication, stuff like that. So this is a very great source of information and data for other researchers. So I think we will have especially people from a traditional sports field come in, grab the data, and use it to analyze performance, not just in gaming and esports, but just like in general.
Yeah, I think the provision of having accessible VODs almost immediately, like wherever it lands, then we'd play and then we'd come back and we'd just go and watch our game straight away and sort of see what was going on, break it down, have a look at that. Whereas I don't think that's too common with traditional sports athletes to go ahead and review their gameplay almost immediately and have instantaneous feedback. So I think we're very lucky in that regards to sort of be able to have access to those tools and yeah, sort of utilize that for our performance.
What's the level you're analyzing it? Are you just like looking at the game and talking about what happened in game, or also talking about like things about communication, how people were sitting, how they were feeling at that moment, what happened before? Or is it really just strictly about, okay, this happened in game, so we cannot do it anymore?
Usually I would talk about, I guess, the feelings going into the series, the feelings during the series, and then after it. From a stats perspective, we're pretty lucky with Rocket League is that we have so many stats accessible towards us. We can see how much boost we picked up. We can see how much time we spent in our defensive third in comparative to the offensive third, how much mid boost we got, how much we demoed. There's so much positioning data which helps create the game of Rocket League, which we can utilize. But we can also look directly and see what other teams are doing, right? So prior to going into a versing a team, all of their data we pretty much have. So we can sort of see where do they play, where do they position, what do they favor, what are some of their star players, what do they tend to do in terms of rotation? Do they sort of cut back in? Do they fully rotate back? And pick up these little micro tendencies. Which I think is really important because you can really just do it so accessible. So yeah, I think in Rocket League, we're pretty lucky with that. And I imagine across a few other games like CS, it's pretty easy to look at a demo, StarCraft, got a good replay viewer, probably can't, you know, in terms of the info. I'm not too sure about League and that sort of stuff, but I imagine they have a pretty in-depth replay viewer. But yeah, again, the premise of being able to review and have a look at information is so important.
Mm.
Fantastic.
It's interesting.
Now, I guess as we turn off the engine and roll down the hill towards the end of the episode, on the topic of research, I'd love to deep into some of your research you've done, sort of share a bit about what you've sort of looked at, researched, had a bit of a review it, and sort of share it with the listeners.
Yeah, so as I said before, my research focuses on individual and team performance in esports and gaming.
Mm.
So I really look at the driving factors that also contributes to individual performance, like in StarCraft 2, 1v1 game, but also the things that happen inside a team. And just a few weeks ago, together with Dr. Retze and Dr. Ilman from Germany, both from Germany, we published a paper and we analyzed 92 studies in gaming and esports and looked at all the factors we found that contribute to performance in teams. So just like a team level analysis. And what we use to analyze data or like put them in a framework is the IMOI framework. It's just like a standard which just stands for input, mediator, outcome, and input. And you can just think about it like having three different buckets.
Yep.
The last bucket is the outcomes. So this is typically your performance outcome. This is how satisfied people are with their own performance, with their job, their member performance, team viability, stuff like that.
Yep.
Then you have the input factors, which are typically whatever the team or like individual players bring to the table. This is what we talked about, for instance, personality traits, right?
Mm.
And on a team level, however, we have the team formation. So how are people recruited in gaming? How do they form a team? How is the team familiarity? So know they each other or just like random people you would meet on the ladder if you just like hit the ladder button, right?
Yep.
Versus playing online or offline with a team in a tournament. Then we also have their culture, their nationality, just stuff like that. Reward system, so something that is the environment, not just the team factors, but also the environment. And also the leadership. As you know, as a coach, you're not really part of the team who plays the game, but you're part of the team, but not like the team who actually plays the game.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like the support structure, which is also family, friends. Their training routines, how their practice looks like, their physical performance and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the bucket in the middle is something like all the processes you can imagine. So you have the process of communication, which is like super important. So this is something you can impact, but it's more like a process that either works or it doesn't, and you can tweak it and stuff like that. You have the in-game actions. So is one player kicking the ball? Why is he standing there but not there? Should he go over there?
Yeah.
And the other things that it also belongs in this bucket are called team emerging states.
Mm.
So these are states that develop over the time as the team progressive. So this could be team cohesion. So team cohesion, one of the very, very major factors you want to look at.
Yep.
This is something you should do. For instance, if you're with your team, you probably know this and you probably are doing this. You shouldn't just spend all the time of with the team inside the gaming house, practicing same environment, but you also want to go out with them, just have some fun, take a day off, do whatever team activity, grab dinner together, whatever.
Yeah.
So this is something that emerges over time. Same with motivation. So the motivation of the players of the team, their shared cognition.
Mm.
Shared cognition is something like, do I think the same thing as you do? And if so, that's probably good for performance, right? Because I give you an information, then this information might be like do this and that, but also could initiate or signal what I want to do. And if they share the cognition, have the same feeling of what the other person is going to do, and this is going to help them to like perform, coordinate better and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Another big factor is positive team climate. So you don't want to have three different players who just sit there, you know, like stare at the camera, don't talk much.
Yeah.
But you want to have a positive climate. And this is probably something that you actually create before the game with your speech.
Yep.
So like, guys, have no regrets, you know, don't worry about it. Play your best, have fun and stuff like that. So this actually creates a positive team environment, which really helps the players to perform their top level. And the last thing that we found is conflict stages. So there are a lot of studies out there on toxic behavior, like in-game toxic behavior, and how that impacts performance. And it shouldn't surprise you that being toxic doesn't really help.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, that's basically the three big things we found and some of the things that belong in the bucket that is there in research. But what we are lacking, what we don't really much about, is how these input factors, like whatever the team brings to the tables, the individual brings to the tables, like team recruiting, friends, family, training routines and stuff, how these things impact the mediators. So how do the, let's say, family support, how do does impact team cohesion?
Mm.
How does it impact the team climate? Are the parents completely out of the picture, or like, are they involved in some way? Are they talking to their sons who are playing? Are they not talking to them? Are they also talking to the other people?
Yep.
Or are they just like completely away from home? Also the communication, like how do certain coaching behaviors impact not just team cohesion, but also the team climate?
Mm-hmm.
How does it impact in-game actions? For instance, if you take a, not the break, but where you can jump in as a coach. What was it? I'm lagging the word right now. What you said, when you take a break when you're 2-0 behind.
Timeout.
Like when you're timeout, exactly. That's what,
yep.
That's what I was looking for. If you take a timeout, like how does the in-game behavior changes afterward?
Mm.
Does it impact the team cohesion at that moment? Does it impact their emotion? Does it impact the team communication? So this is the kind of stuff we don't know yet.
Yeah. No, interesting. I love that. I think that covers so many domains of esports.
Yeah.
Really sort of reflecting over each statement, I've sort of experienced, I guess, yeah, every single one of those factors across the last 4 years at the pro level. So I think it's, yeah, definitely an important factors to consider towards esports performance. So yeah, that's awesome. For everyone listening, yeah. is the study or the review available to read out there?
Yes, it is. It's completely available for free.
Great. I'll make sure to put that in the description. I'll put that on the website as well so that people can to go and have a look at the findings. Is there any more research for you on the horizon? Any next steps?
Yes. So I'm currently working on two papers.
Cool.
The first one I already touched on a little bit, where we are analyzing Counter-Strike data.
Yep.
And we have a data set of 40,000 matches.
Right. That's a lot.
A lot. Yeah, so we currently have Dr. Hillman and his team, like his bachelor students, working on a program where we can see how strategies evolve in Counter-Strike and try to predict at an instance what the strategy of the team is.
Yep.
And if something happens, like something negative, let's say one of the guys dies, does it change the strategy, how they are going to adapt to it? And for that research, as I already said, we have like data that is massively overblown, if you want to call it like that. We already talked to some university league teams,
mm-hmm.
in Germany. So we had some interviews and asked them to help us analyze the data a little bit to just get a feeling of what's important when it comes to strategies. How do you adapt to strategies? When do you do it? And stuff like that.
Yep.
And it's, yeah, we got some really great insights from that. But that study is still going to take a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
The second study I'm working on right now is a review similar to what we did on the team level.
Yep.
But the research we're doing right now is tag the individual level as well. So we are looking at all the factors that drive performance in gaming and esports, not just on a team, but also on the individual level, and how these factors in these three buckets impact each other. So for instance, how can the personality trait of an individual, how does this may impact the team communication or team cohesion? How does it impact team performance and stuff? So for that, we probably going to have about 200 and more papers we are analyzing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be a really big one. But hopefully it's going to be out within, let's say this year, maybe beginning of next year.
Yep.
And the third I'm currently working on is thinking styles.
Oh, okay.
Especially analytical thinking. So what we know from, I don't know if you know the book from Kahneman, which is Thinking Fast and Slow.
No, I haven't heard of that.
Like a bestseller book, okay. Which just has the idea. Like Kahneman is also a Nobel Prize winner, so he's somewhat famous for his book. But I'll just break it down very, very fast. He says there are two modes of thinking. The first one is very fast and intuitive. So that's something like you have a gut feeling. Or if I ask you what's 2 + 2, you immediately know the answer. You don't have to think about it.
Yep.
And the second bucket is like analytical, reflective, slow thinking. So when I ask you what's 120 times 1,545, you're really going like, okay, let me really think about it, right?
Yeah.
And this is also something that happens when you encounter a situation that you don't know.
Yeah.
If you exactly know what you do, then you just have to think about it. You just do it. But if you encounter something that is new, that you don't know where to go, what to do, then you go into this reflective, slower thinking. And this, I think, happens a lot in gaming. Mm. And I'm analyzing right now videos, audio files from TFT matches.
Okay, cool.
Where people stream their matches and they're obviously talking a lot. So I'm analyzing how much are they reflective thinking? How much are they engaging in the slow, deliberate thinking? What are they thinking about? Is it reflective? Is it analytical thinking? Is it hypothetical thinking? Something like, maybe I should this, but I should also do this. Mm. But if I do this, then maybe this happens. And then they decide for one of the alternatives.
Yeah.
And I'm really trying to get my feet into what are they thinking about? How often are they thinking? And is more analytical thinking better for performance or is it not? Is it better to just like go with your gut feeling or is it better to just like really sit down, take a deep breath, think about the situation, think about all the possible ways you could go down and then make a decision?
Oh, cool. I like that. I think that's an important aspect towards, I guess, research in terms of thinking styles. I think that's really an interesting one. So definitely one I'll be curious to see the results of.
Do you have any experience with that? Like, do you know, or like from a perspective of playing yourself, do you think a lot, or is it just like playing, not thinking, just gut feeling?
I think it makes sense that when we're in situations that we're familiar with, then it's more autonomous in terms of what we think. I think that's definitely true for situations that I've been in, I guess, on LAN, where we've been in a situation that where we've experienced it before. I think it's really interesting to sort of look at it in the perspective that, you know, previously, there's one really good example whereby the first major that we went to in Sweden, we played Furia. So one, at that time, South America's best team, and we took a timeout and we ended up winning that series. And then the following major in LA, we played them again. So it was that sort of cognitive understanding that, hey, yes, we're the underdogs, but we've done it before. So as long as we sort of have, I guess, that same mindset, that same approach towards, it's not a mountain that we have to take 40,000 steps up. We just have to take each step at a time and sort of put ourselves in a situation that feels familiar. And we pretty much stuck to exactly what we did back in Sweden in terms of the play style. And it worked pretty well. So I think, you know, that sort of has a bit of an impact, I guess, on a LAN setting, creating familiar things at one checkpoint, but then being able to sort of relapse back to that. Almost like what I define for myself and plays is building out your own mental template of when to sort of relapse back onto things, when to sort of understand, hey, I've been in this situation before, I can lapse back onto that, I can utilize that, I can, you know, if it's something that's new, what can I do with that previous information that helps create a new experience, which I think is powerful in itself, right? So yeah, I think it's important aspect towards both modalities of thinking.
Do you have any insights on the communication of players during their gameplay, like doing tournament gameplays? Are they just like communicating, hey, do this, do that, whatever, but also like analytical thinking, hey, maybe we should do this, maybe we should do that? And do you have like a, let's say, like a feeling for how much is this analytical and how much communication is actually, let's just do that, we're gonna do this, this is our next move?
Yeah, in Rocket League, it's because it's a 5-minute game, so it's communication is one of the biggest, I've said this across every single team I've been on, communication is the biggest predictor of our performance in Rocket League. And because of that, I always drive commanding comms. So instead of like, oh, should I do something? It's, hey, do this. Hey, get boost me. Hey, you play the ball. Hey, I'm behind you. Get back. I'm taking it slow. Play for me. And sort of giving each other, I guess, directive commands in terms of what we want to do, because as soon as we get on that same page and build that trust in the comm, If you can take in the comm, listen to the comm, and trust the comm, and execute based on what the comm is, and I guess build up familiarity with that, then it makes you such a better, I guess, composed team overall, and you're able to sort of execute more efficiently, is what I found. Whereas I think if you're taking it more analytical, that's probably more after the game, sort of having a bit of a reflective approach. What worked well? Why did it work well? What didn't work well? What can we do differently? And again, similarly, what we talked about before in the timeouts, like that's probably where that comes into play. But yeah, definitely in game, it's very much three players simultaneously talking over each other. Very, very. The first time I joined Rocket League, the first time I was able to scream, I was like, oh my God, I've actually got a headache after listening to this for an hour. But then obviously adapted over time. And, you know, the best way for my plays is that to make sense of comms, what I would do is I would close my eyes and I would say, boys, paint me the picture. Paint me the picture of what you're doing on the field through your comms so that I can see what you're doing. And that means, you know, your teammate also understands the comm as well. And then gradually over time, what we would do is that we would get into a point where with some of my players, like even on the way, like on a bus or on a plane, we would play a mental game of Rocket League just based on comms. So we could all close our eyes and start comming for each other and actually actively play a game of Rocket League just based on our comms. And I think that's where we got to a level of just, yeah, pure team cohesion, which was pretty special.
It's also imaginary practicing.
Exactly. Yeah, it was good. Yeah. I remember lying in bed one night because we had to like share rooms. So I had like a player, and we just like before we went to bed, like play a game Rocket League, and it was just like calling out for each other. It was fun. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting aspect for sure.
Also a new stream of research that has emerged in the last years, which is like how can you improve your training, not just like physical training and moving, but just by imagining. And we notice from gymnasts, for instance, that they go through the same routine over and over and over again, not just like physically doing it, but also in their head.
Yeah.
And at some point, they're just very good at executing it because the head knows exactly what to do.
So yeah, I'm 6 months away from finishing my master's in exercise physiology. And I've read some previous research, I think it's been either research or anecdotal, or I've seen it online. I've seen it somewhere. But I guess people in rehab who don't have too much limb functioning in terms of motor control recruitment, sort of imagining and creating strong, vivid visualizations of them lifting weights.
Yep.
And then having sort of motor unit recruitment and I guess not regressing the muscle to, I guess, delay atrophy, which has been pretty beneficial just from having visualizations. So, yeah, I think that the power and I guess the importance of really good, strong, vivid visualizations is pretty special as well.
Yeah. It's also something called phantom pain, right? When people lose their limbs.
Yeah.
They sometimes feel this pain and you can relieve it by like imagining like really clenching your fist that isn't there anymore. And sometimes this actually relieves the pain.
Crazy. Yeah, that's definitely an area of research as well. That's pretty crazy. Awesome.
But just one more thing I want to touch on. What you said about communication is not just true from your perspective, but also from the research perspective. And I think this is one of the big differences that I talked about before when it comes to different genres. Rocket League is a game where it's like constant action, right?
Yeah.
So you have to have very clear communication. You have to say, hey, we're going to do this, then we're going to do that. This is what we focus on, whatever. But in games such as League of Legends or Dota, you have a little bit more time between these action phases, right?
Absolutely.
So you have a fight for Baron, you have a fight for Dragon, whatever. But in between that, you have like 2, 5, whatever minutes where nothing really is going to happen. Mm. And the difference in communication is there during these action phases. It's like really clear communication. Do this, go in, we're going to fight, whatever, go, go, go. And between that, it's more like, hey, what should we do next? Should we set up wards there? Should we do this and that? So there is more space for discussing.
Yeah.
Right? So these are very, very interesting levels of changes in communication.
I think that's really interesting as well. I always reflect back to just watching different League of Legends lands and then looking at like someone returning back to base, then walking back to lane. And you know, sometimes it takes them 20, 30 seconds to get back to lane. So having that bit of a, I guess, I guess, individualized debrief from the game to tell us to sort of take 20 seconds to sort of reset yourself before you get back to lane, before you get back into it, which I think is pretty crazy to sort of have that.
Yeah.
I guess because in Rocket League you don't get that at all. But, yeah, I think it's nice. You know, you see it in CS in between rounds. When you die potentially as well, you know, you can't have too much of an impact, but you can sort of sit there and sort of think about maybe what happens next. If you're the IGL, if you die early, what's the next play? Are we going to execute A? Are we going to go B? And sort of pre-contemplating the comms, the communication that you want to present to the team as well, yep. Which I think is important for games, for sure.
Yeah. Maybe if I may, there's one more research I would like to touch on.
Mm.
Which kind of brings us back to the start where you asked, like, are there environmental factors? And this may be interesting for you when you set up your team for, like, practice and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is, there's one study out there who took the data from League of Legends matches in, I think it was South Korea.
Mm.
And they also took the data from the cities they played in during rush hour and during... no rush hour,
yeah.
Air pollution. So they looked at air pollution during the time of the tournament, and they took the tournament data, and they analyzed it on an individual and team level. And what they found was when there's a higher level of air pollution, so for instance during rush hour, then the performance dropped.
Wow!
It was not just a performance drop on the individual on a team level, but there was also a difference in the team in the individual behavior. And between the teams. So for instance, usually you have like a higher ranked team plays versus a lower ranked team. And you would expect a certain, you know, difference between them, a certain percentage that team would win, but also the higher team would win. And what they found was when the air pollution was higher, then this gap increased.
Mm.
So basically air pollution impacted the lower performing team even more than it did for the higher performance team. And one reason this might happen was the second finding of the study, which was the team became more risk-seeking.
Right.
So, for instance, if you're in a bad condition, like air pollution-wise, then it impacts your body and it impacts your mental. And people just go for whatever risk behavior they think is appropriate right now. So instead of being very clear, mentally focused, they just start like being very risky, making risky moves, taking risky outcomes, and et cetera. So yeah, I would kind of like bring this back to you where you said you're in team houses, you practice and whatnot. So maybe making sure that the team house is not right next to a street that is very like populated, a lot of driveway, a lot of rush hour, a lot of air pollution might be a good thing to just get in a very much better practice area, practice environment, not just for the players, but also for yourself.
Yeah, sort of controlled environment. And sort of thinking about that, I was reflecting to the first time back in 2021, we went to Gamers 8, so the first Esports World Cup in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, Gamers 8, yeah.
Yeah, going into that environment, the heat, the humidity, going from hot into aircon, hot into aircon, sort of that was definitely, I feel like, a factor for some of my players. And I saw other players like having experiences like they were getting heat stroke, they were getting overwhelmed by the heat, and just players who have never experienced that level before. So I think that is definitely a very interesting sort of facet as well when you mention that.
I wonder if air pollution is the same for people who play EWC. Because there you may not have as much like air pollution from cars and stuff. But what about the sand?
Yeah.
Is it the same thing?
Yeah, the dust.
People, are individuals, teams going to perform worse because of that?
Mm. Tricky thing, but it's hard to how would you measure that, do you think? It's hard to measure if that's the direct thing that's having an impact.
Maybe you can measure if there was like a sandstorm before, so
okay,
like dust and stuff in the air, or it's not.
Yeah,
interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so this is all basically all the research we are lacking, like what happens with the outside environment, how important is it?
Yeah,
like, how big is the impact?
Yeah.
What are people doing to bring themselves into a good condition?
Yeah, all interesting sort of areas of research that which I hope that we expand into over the next coming years. Maybe another one to add to your platter as well.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting, right?
Absolutely.
We all love the games. We love esports. You especially are very much into making sure people perform their best.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like knowing all the stuff is like great benefit to you, great benefit to the players.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a collective effort to ensure that, I guess, player well-being and player performance is, yeah, taken care of or had some attention towards.
Yeah. And this is something I'd like to stress to let's say, people who are more on the practical side as well. Like, people always try to draw from the science and look up whatever we already know. Mm. But at the same time, and I could speak from a personal perspective, if you reach out to people and be like, hey, would you be interested in helping us with this research, maybe half an hour interview, then people are very quick when it comes to declining. So everyone watching who's like working in esports, maybe think twice the next time someone, well, a researcher reaches out to you and asks you to like contribute. Could this, the stuff we are talking about, the science stuff, this is only possible because we have data. And if we don't have data, then we don't know anything.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, hopefully a lot of listeners can take into account that and start contributing more, which would be good.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, for everyone listening, where can we find you? Socials? Where can we reach out, get connected to you? LinkedIn, your website?
Yeah, so easiest way is probably to just find me on X. It's like Traidos, Traidos. And there, all the rest of my socials are linked. My website, my newsletter, my LinkedIn, my Instagram, whatever.
Beautiful. Yeah, I'll be sure to put that in the description. And then, yeah, that'll be put everywhere and distributed nicely for people to reach out, and maybe they've got some questions for you or some more subscribers. Absolutely. Subscribers for your newsletter, hopefully. We'll see what happens, but yeah, again, really, really appreciate it today jumping on, Christian. I'm sure that a lot of viewers can take a lot from today's episode, or at least I hope they do, because it was jam-packed with so many pivotal insights into towards esports performance and some aspects that I hadn't even considered before, which I think is really important just to take into account what we can do for the future, how we can build better teams, how we can build and support players to be the best they can. And overall just contribute towards the esports industry and I guess the future of esports as well. So I really appreciate you jumping on.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Legend. Thanks, mate.